Uh-oh. You're gonna need to save ass and continue.
Esto es Comando Z,
donde el fracaso no es opcional, pero el éxito es obligatorio. Con ustedes, Lace Curbelo.
Aquí, Lace Curbelo. Today we will be talking about a topic that everybody thinks that they know really well, but the reality is that some designers actually do it and use it. But first, if you enjoy what you are listening and you are learning with us, just catching up, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts or Facebook. Also, don't forget to share this episode with your coworkers or friends that need some of this valuable information. Episode of today, Prototyping Your Designs with Paul Seymour. Paul has been a professional designer since the first dot-com boom. Seymour has a freelance business called Litmoonbox that started in 2008 as a web and mobile development agency. He worked with a range of organizations, both on hands-on designers as well as manager, solving user problems for a wide variety of the cases. In that time, he overseen virtually every part of the product design process, from design sprints to usability testing, enabled him to speak fluently to designers, developers, PMs, and top-level stakeholders. Currently, he is the lead UX designer at ServiceNow. What you will learn from Paul, here are the takeaways. Number one, learn how prototype based on your type of project. Number two, listen what kind of tools are the best currently for digital prototyping. Number three, discover the importance of prototyping in an industry that moves so rapidly that you need to sell your designs first to the stakeholders in order to present to the users. And now, listen with us, Paul Seymour in Prototyping Your Designs. Así que dale oído. Aquí, Lace Curbelo. This is another episode of Come and See Podcast. This is an episode in English. It has been a long time when we do a lot of Spanish interviews, but today we have one special guest from the United States. Welcome to Paul Seymour. How are you, Paul?
Good. How are you doing, Lacey?
Doing great. I'm super excited to have you on the podcast. Today we will talk about a topic that every designer think that they know, but when they had to do it, is the time when the questions came. Today we will talking about prototyping. So tell us who you are and what you do for a living, Paul.
So I am a staff product designer at ServiceNow. And I've been basically of various permutations of product designer for the last 15 years or something like that. So basically that's what I do.
Small time, right? Like really, like just 15 years.
Not it means I'm an old guy, so I don't always like play that one up as like my first criteria, but yeah.
I don't say that. I will say a lot of experience. Come on.
Experience, that's what I, yeah, I'll go with experience. It sounds great.
Let's start with the basic. What is prototyping and how you define the process?
So prototyping is basically creating like a facsimile of a final product. And in order to understand it better, that's basically what a prototype is. And so you can basically, the facsimile can vary in terms of fidelity, like how complete, how similar is it to the final product or how different? And so you could approach prototyping and kind of at different times during a project. Like at the beginning, you could start off with low fidelity, which is like sketching, like pen and ink and pen and paper. And especially for me, because I'm a terrible sketcher, it's really, really low fidelity. But basically that could be useful for just ideating really, really simple ideas, like, and do it really quick. Here, what about one of these? No? Well, what about one of those? Later on in a project, you can kind of raise the fidelity a bit and start creating sort of a series of screens or kind of a flow of screens. You can show them to prospective users to kind of get a validation of like, is this sort of the direction we want to go? And then maybe towards the end, when you've kind of finished your design and you want to make sure that it's usable for usability testing, you can make a kind of a more high fidelity prototype that does all the stuff or does as much of the stuff as you want to test. And then you can let users actually play with that themselves. So then you're looking at something more high fidelity. Those are kind of like, I would kind of group them that way.
Interesting, because sometimes when I think about prototyping, I just think one phase of the product. But now that you explain it in that way, I realize that I do a lot of prototyping.
Yeah, anytime you bust out a pen and start drawing something, you've basically created a prototype.
Definitely. When you have the sketch and you just draw some squares on the page.
Exactly. End of the day, Lacey, that's what we do. We draw squares. That's how I kind of describe it.
I have a good friend that they say when you pass from graphic design to US, it's basically like changing the colors to gray. It's really sad to hear that.
Yeah. And when you were a graphic designer, you probably drew some other shapes too, circles, triangles, that kind of thing. But basically, once you're a UX designer, it's all about squares.
The squares and grays. Wow, that's amazing.
Exactly.
Tell us about a little bit of the process.
So, okay. So basically, as you are going through your product design process, you end up including a bunch of assumptions in your design. It's just inevitable. We as designers, we think we're pretty smart. We know what makes good design. But basically, we're not designing usually for ourselves. So we're just packing in a bunch of assumptions like, oh, yeah, that'll work. Or, oh, yeah, that'll work. So basically, you have to take a hard look at your design and determine what are the unvalidated assumptions. What are the things that you just thought were a good idea, but you haven't actually heard any of your users confirm that that's a good idea. So basically, you identify those assumptions. And then you imagine what kind of interactions you would need to see in order to validate those assumptions. So for example, let's say we're designing a search engine, say. And so you've got a text field at the top. And then after you put in the results, maybe you've got some filters and stuff like that. So basically, we want to test that. So basically, we would say we want to test the filters. So what kind of interactions would our prototype need to have in order to test those filters? Well, we have to show the filters on the page along with some search results. And the filters would have to be somewhat meaningful. And somebody would have to be able to like click on them or in some way select them and then see the results change. So basically, that would be a validation that, yes, our filter design worked. So basically, we have to imagine like that those kinds of interactions are what we need in order to validate that. And then we say, what's the easiest way to create those interactions? So basically, that's the main bottom line for prototyping is we want to be able to get a meaningful signal. But we don't want to spend a lot of time. In fact, the less time, the better. And so we say, what's the easiest way that we could create something like that? Then we identify who are the users that could actually provide this validation. Like in the search engine case, we say, you know, who are the users that are going to be using this search engine? And what kind of things are they going to be searching for? So we'll kind of seek those people out. Then we'll write a script. We'll say, okay, here's the whole process by which these users are going to experience my prototype. And we're going to write it out. Like you go to this screen and then what do you do here? And then you go to that screen and what do you do there? Then once we've got the script in hand, now we build the prototype and we follow it to the script. So in the case of my search engine, I'd need to build a prototype that had a before search state. So basically it's like an empty state. And then you type in a thing and then it's a populated state. Now you've got results and now you've got your filters. And then I would need to make it so you can click on the filters. So basically those are kind of the requirements of my prototype. Next, we got to recruit the users. We already identified the type of people we want to use, but we actually have to find the individuals. And then we conduct the interviews. Sometimes a researcher will conduct the interviews because there's a certain amount of skill to it. However, I strongly recommend that the designers at least be on the call and listen, if not doing it themselves. And I'll get to this later. And then once you've done the interviews and you've got the results, you synthesize the results. Basically, you go through and you tease out patterns and so forth. And then you share those results out. So basically, that's kind of the beginning to end process for prototyping.
I have a story and a question for you. So when I was little, I was really into it, how movies was made. Like in Disney, like for me, the animation was amazing. Like see these people drawing one page to another and trying to do animations through the different pages. But they have like reference, you know, they have a reference from human body. They have reference of how animals can move. But when we do prototyping, it's basically doing an animation of like the interaction that the user will have with the prototype, with the product itself. So it's interesting how you have like that kind of reference to start doing something that you are not reinventing the wheel. You are basically taking some different approaches and trying to make it something new. What is your approach on that?
Well, basically, like if we're going to reinvent wheels, first of all, a lot of wheels have been already invented. On like say we're designing for the web or even for mobile or anything, tons of wheels have been invented. In fact, the search engine example that I gave earlier, like we've we've got search engines. We've had search engines for like 20 years, and people are used to using them. So I recommend only reinventing wheels if that wheel specifically does not exist. And so, for example, if I were going to build a new search engine, we're going to probably want to use as much of the existing conventions of search engines as we can in order to meet our requirements, because that's what people are already used to. And then they can come to our search engine. They don't have to be taught. It's obvious. Now, let's say we have some special requirements that are only relative to our use case in a search engine, say, like type ahead. Sometimes type ahead will have a bunch of really quite different ways that it gets implemented because of some specific thing. Like as you're typing, you know, the standard thing that you'll see in Google is you'll just get a list of results as you're typing, and those are your type ahead recommendations. However, if you're searching through any number of different types of things, sometimes those type ahead results will come back and they'll be in different buckets. Like, are you looking for a person? Like, think about LinkedIn. If you type something in LinkedIn search, you get this type ahead recommendations that are broken up into people or companies or jobs, I think, and maybe some other stuff. And so it kind of helps you refine, like, what kind of thing are you looking for? So that might be like a special requirement for one particular search engine. But generally speaking, we try to only do that when we have a novel use case and nobody else has really solved it very well. That's when we'll pursue something like that. Otherwise, it's always best, I think, to use what is available.
Listeners, please don't reinvent the wheel if you don't have to.
Now, that doesn't mean that everything has to come out looking the same. You know, basically, like, you know, there is variations of visual design and sort of a general branding scheme that every company and organization and product will have that'll be different. Every search engine, for example, doesn't always have to look like Google. But, you know, for example, Google has that big search field at the top, you know, so you probably don't want to create your search engine with your search field at the bottom, for example. Like, people are going to be confused by that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm, definitely. So I heard a lot that designers think that they don't need to follow a process to do prototyping. They think that it's just like sketching it out. So why designers need to understand and apply the process to designs?
Well, basically, the painful truth is that every designer needs to acknowledge this, is we are almost never designing for ourselves. Like, basically, we're not usually the users of the product that we're designing. It's other people. And those other people are in a different situation than us. And yes, we can do our best to imagine what that situation might be. But end of the day, we are not those people. And so we need to understand what those people, our actual users, need and what's going to make sense for them. And so that's the main value of prototyping and doing this kind of user testing. And also, from a designer's point of view, the ability to empathize with your users is absolutely crucial. You have to care that they can, say in your search engine, they're trying to solve some problem, not just finding some page, but it's going to satisfy some need in their life, apparently. And so you have to kind of embrace that problem. And you have to say, okay, this is a problem. How are we going to solve this? And so to actually engage in user testing and build prototypes and watch users actually work through those prototypes ends up and actually watch them, like by watching them, I mean face-to-face or at least on a Zoom or something like that, so that you can actually develop the empathy for these people. Otherwise, it's really easy to forget that we are actually designing for human beings. Like, you start designing for JIRA, you know, like this JIRA ticket says that I need to deliver this thing. So here, I've delivered that thing. Okay, now I'm done. But basically, doing prototyping reminds you that there's actually faces behind these products, and maybe millions of them that are going to be struggling through your terrible design unless you get it right, basically. And so that's the main value.
I can add another value that I think it's really important for designers, how you sell your designs. Like, sometimes you had to do a prototype just to present your idea to stakeholders or to managers. And that's the first step to sell that the idea works, you know? And then you need to sell your idea to your users. So prototyping is basically like a tool to sell your ideas, to prove that your ideas works. So I see another value on that side.
Lacey, that's a really good point. In fact, I totally omitted that, and that's a really crucial one, is to actually get stakeholders on board. And you know, unlike designers, a lot of designers, if you're just having a conversation about designs with designers, and you say, yeah, then we'll put these like horizontal tabs across the top, and then we'll do blah, blah, blah. And a lot of times other designers can visualize what you're talking about. It's like, oh yeah, yeah, I could totally see that. Mm-hmm. However, if you're talking to non-designer stakeholders, a lot of times they don't visualize that because their skills lie elsewhere. And so in that case, even to just communicate the idea and get them on board, yes, you need to create something so that they can interact with it and play with it and start to see the value of it. So yes, totally correct.
So now that we are talking about selling ideas, sometimes like you can do a prototype on a paper, and sometimes you can do it like really in detail. So let's talk about the elephant in the room. Low fidelity versus high fidelity prototyping, the pros and cons, what in your expertise, what works best? It's about like the details, or it's about like the how quickly do you can put together a prototype?
So the general rule, I would say, is the lower the fidelity, the better, as long as you can get out of it what you need to get out of it. And so, and that amounts to the amount of effort that you put into it. Basically, prototyping almost always creates throwaway work. By throwaway work, I mean it's not going to go into the final product. Like your little sketch on a piece of paper, they're going to throw that in the recycling bin at some point. Even your fancy like Axure prototype, or if you do an HTML prototype, eventually that's all going to get thrown away, and some actual coders are going to build the final product. And so the less, and plus there's also a timeline to consider. It's like you need to deliver this deadline, this design by whatever deadline. And so the less time you spend prototyping, the more time you actually have to design. So the less, the better. However, so basically like low, but it comes down to your purpose. And so if we're just ideating, like say, Leishi, you and I are ideating on like five different ways to do a search engine. We can come up with sketches. Like we can spend 30 seconds on each one. Like here's one, it's this thing up here. And here's this other thing, it goes down the side. And here's like, I don't know what the other three would be. But anyhow, we could come up with those really quickly. Now they're gonna look terrible. We're not gonna ever wanna show those to finished users. We're probably not even gonna wanna show them to our boss. However, for our purpose, we can totally understand what we're talking about by doing that. And so it totally meets our purpose. Now in the case of you're trying to sell a concept to a stakeholder, you're not going to probably want to go with the sketches. So especially if it's a group of stakeholders that are not involved in ideating, it's more of a review. So you need to make those higher fidelity. Now, how high, and or do they need to be clickable and all that kind of thing? That's kind of depends on what your organization is like. But in most organizations I've seen, they need to have a little bit of a wow factor. Especially if it's a controversial product, like that is, if there's a bunch of completely competing ideas floating around in the room, you want to make those ideas shine as best as possible. Sometimes I think of it as like, you know, that scene in Gone with the Wind, The Wizard of Oz. In The Wizard of Oz, you know how it goes from black and white to color when she like lands in her house after the cyclone, and then she opens her door, and then it's all color outside. And maybe the first time you ever saw that movie, I don't know when that could have been, but basically you probably went like, oh wow, cool. You know, I thought this was a black and white movie, and now it's like all in color.
It's true.
That's kind of it's a good response to get from a design, to go like, oh wow, that's cool. So basically it's like, you don't, sometimes it doesn't have to be fully high fidelity to get that, but sometimes it does. And so like for showing stakeholders, you want to get a little bit of a wow factor. Now for usability, you sometimes want to go really high. Depends on, for example, I worked for this company years back, and the product that we were building was a native mobile app, and it was a medical device company, and this app had to be approved by the FDA for usability. So you can imagine the FDA has some really serious requirements in terms of usability. And so first they said they wanted to build a prototype. They didn't want to actually build the product and have them test with that. They wanted to do it with a prototype. So, okay. So this app would do a lot of different things. And the users were, you know, kind of an elderly group, usually like 60 and above, and not super technically literate. And so we started off with this really simple prototype. You click here, you click here, you click here, and then that's your success. Well, the users didn't click in all those right spots. And so we were sitting on the other side of one-way glass, and we're like, wait, the whole test is broken now because they didn't do the first step that we expected them to do. So then we realized that they might approach it in a wide variety of ways. And so we had to create a prototype that would accommodate them doing these tasks in any possible order they might think of. And it would still work so that we didn't suddenly ruin the test. And so in that case, we had to make this prototype so high fidelity. It was with final visual design at retina resolution, so like a double resolution. It had to look and behave exactly like a native app, so they wouldn't even notice that it was actually just it, we did it in Axure. But and they could proceed in any different direction. They could enter numbers and letters and stuff, and that information that they'd entered would be fed back to them on the other screens. And so like, and that was required for that. That was a tremendous amount of work. It totally would have violated my the least amount of effort possible, except for the fact that this was literally the least amount of effort we could get away with, was just a tremendous amount of effort.
Wow. You know what? In my case, I will say, like, do everything or nothing. So I present some ideas from papers, like prototyping papers, some sketches. But when I do the middle, like when you buy a steak and you cut it and it's medium rare, medium rare prototype, usually like stakeholders say like, oh, something missing here. Or they say like, oh, I think it's too much right now. So in my case, in my opinion, you can go really high, so you present almost the product, or you go really, really like sketching it out, so you can sell the idea and you can buy then on the project. But yeah, I don't know why in my case, medium rare prototyping, no, that's not well.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because I've actually got a story around that too. Another big medical company, I won't say who their name is, but we were working for them some years ago, and we were doing wireframing, but we made our wireframes a bit high fidelity. We added in their brand color, for example, and their logo, and we used the fonts that they use on their website. And so you could look at this thing and think, well, maybe this is a final design, you know, like if you didn't know what the rest of the brand was supposed to look like. Well, unfortunately, some of the top stakeholders did exactly that. And they took our wireframes as the final design. And we kept saying, no, these are wireframes. But they kept giving us visual design feedback. We're like, we don't want visual design feedback. We're not in visual design yet. We just want to know if you think that box belongs over there, or if you think it belongs over there. But they loved the design so much that they ended up basically creating their visual design sort of out of the stuff that we'd put in the wireframes. And so that wasn't really what we wanted. And so we learned from that experience is to make your wireframes look like wireframes. Don't make them look like visual design, because otherwise people are going to give you the wrong information and all you want to know is where to put the boxes. And they're going to tell you like, oh, that green isn't very nice, is it? You know, that kind of thing. I don't care about the green. I didn't mean to put the green in. So like, forget about the green. So yeah, basically making it clear, the fidelity should help communicate what kind of feedback you're looking for from this thing. And this is particularly with stakeholders, not so much with users. With users, you kind of have to get whatever feedback they tell you. But if you go to a design review with, like, say, the top management, and you show them a wireframe, you don't want to hear about fonts. You don't want to hear about colors. You want to hear about anything like that. You want to hear about placement, screen flow, that kind of thing. So sometimes you'll just precede the conversation. You'll say, here's the kind of feedback I'm looking for, not visual design. I'm looking for blah, blah, blah. And so, so yeah, the fidelity of your visual design is pretty important as far as the kind of response it's going to get.
Definitely. Same here, you know, like it was so funny. I was hearing you and I was remember one time that I do a medium rare prototype and I put some content instead of Lorem Ipsum. And everybody was like, I don't buy that sentence. You know, I don't think that feels like marketing. It was like, no, forget about the content. It's just for a placeholder.
Yes, that's the worst, is when they start giving you copy feedback. It's like, I just made that copy up. Like, yeah, totally.
Okay, so let's move on. Can you talk about different prototyping methodologies? Paper, digital, HTML? Like, tell us about methodologies.
Yeah, so paper, I'm going to start with paper, even though that's the one that I use the least, because like I said at the beginning, my sketching is hideous, really bad. And so basically the only value that my sketches have is that they didn't take me very long to make, and hopefully they communicate an idea in that short amount of time. And then after that, they should be thrown away. So, but sometimes it can be perfect. Like, let's say we're developing a calendar app and we're having this conversation of how are we going to display the days of a calendar. So we could display them in a month view, or we could display them in a week view, or we could display them as a list under a heading that says the name of the day. And let's say you can't, or maybe you can choose between all three of those views. But if I just tell you month view, week view, you might not totally visualize what I have in mind. So I could quickly sketch that in like 1 minute and say like this, so that we could have like three of those sketches and say, okay, here's our month view, here's our week view, here's our list view. And that's useful for pen and paper. Beyond that sort of ideation, I don't find a great value for pen and paper. And especially if we're designing digital products, which I think is the context of this conversation, I usually am going to go for some digital method of prototyping. And so starting at sort of the simplest is Figma/Envision. And so basically what Figma and Envision, their prototyping functions work similarly, is that they end up displaying on a web page images. And so the images are your final design, but it's not like a HTML page. The page just consists of your images. So it's not like it doesn't support some certain types of interaction, but it will show your design. These ones are pretty easy to create, and they're easy to create kind of high fidelity because they operate with the environment that you're already probably using for your high fidelity designs, which is either Sketch or Figma. So if you're already doing designs in Sketch or Figma, prototyping in Figma or Envision is quite easy. You don't have to move them from one environment to another. They're already in that environment. So you just like make it go live and stitch together your prototype. So that's actually fairly easy. The next more complicated solution, which I've used a lot, is Axure, like I mentioned before. And the benefit that Axure has over, say, Figma and Sketch and Vision is that Axure will actually create a web page containing multiple elements, all the elements that you've included in your design. So, for example, if you've got a text field in your design, it's a real text field, and the user can actually click into it and actually type stuff. Or if you've got a button, like it'll have button behaviors. If you assign like hover, display, and all that kind of stuff, it'll do those things without having to do anything special. The problem with Axure is it's got a pretty steep learning curve. It's a fairly complicated application, and it's not a design tool. So basically, you're probably designing in something else. For example, say Sketch. Now, if you want to do an Axure prototype, you have to go through the process of bringing in your designs from Sketch into Axure, which is kind of a pain. And then if you're using, say, custom fonts, you know, like not your standard web fonts, then you have to go through another process to make sure that those web fonts work with your Axure prototype, which is also kind of a pain. And so this is definitely a level up. And so you wouldn't want to go do that unless you've already accomplished the learning curve and maybe you don't have to show any custom fonts or your requirements require it. And then the third most complicated, the most complicated prototyping method is HTML. And that basically you could just create whatever web technology is possible in the universe can be created at an HTML prototype. And so basically you could do everything. You could do everything that your final product is going to do. These could be pretty time consuming to produce. And generally I haven't worked with very many designers who have that kind of skill to do HTML, CSS, JavaScript. So usually you have to collaborate with somebody else. So you can't do it. Most designers can't do that themselves. So those are kind of how I'd break it up.
It's really complex. And you have to definitely have the skills. You know what? One time I was doing an interview and a person told me, like, it's really important that students and designers understand the importance to do a sketch and prototypes on paper, because, and it was so great, the phrase. It was like, paper, you can throw away your bad ideas. When you start doing on digital, you invest so much time that it's really hard to just get rid of that idea. So paper, it's basically the first filter. of the bad ideas. And I love that. And sometimes I just like, oh, I don't want to do it on paper. But when I start like sketching it out on paper, it was like, okay, this will not work on digital, definitely. So it's a great tool. I would say that at least like if you take you just 10 seconds, just do it.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree.
So what prototyping tools do you recommend? You talk about a little bit of Axure, Figma, Sketch Ambition. What is your favorite?
So I've got a long history with Axure, as I mentioned already, and I know it inside and out, and it'll do a lot of really cool things. However, I've recently made the jump to Figma, and that is simply the best design tool I've worked with in at least 15 years. It's amazing. Granted, the prototyping features are not quite as robust as Axure's, except they're improving all the time. And you can do most stuff. What you cannot do in Figma is you currently can't have, say, text fields that the user can type into and that kind of stuff. And you can't have complex logic. Like if they click on this, and they've clicked on that before, then we're going to send them to a third page. Otherwise, you know, basically it's like it's just showing series of screens. So we can't do anything really responsive to the user. Like here's their name. Like if the user types in their name and now you can show their name on every page, you could do that in Axure. You could not do that too easily in Figma. However, Figma is awesome for every other reason. Basically, Figma is a single tool that is a design tool. It's a prototyping tool, and it's also a handoff tool for the developers, all in one thing. And so in the past, you've had three tools for that, and you had to, and part of the problem was having to migrate your designs between those three tools. Now it just sits in Figma, and then you can be designing, and then you can switch to prototype mode. You say when they click on that, it's going to go over to this thing. And then when it's time for the developers to start building it, they just go straight there. They can grab all your attributes, and all that kind of thing. So basically Figma is just, and there's some features in Figma which I haven't even touched on that just make that's the thing that makes it such a killer tool. In fact, I'll touch on it. It doesn't totally relate to prototyping, but basically the best feature that Figma's got is this thing called auto layout. This is currently as of June 2021. Auto layout is basically like if you've got a take like the Facebook app feed. So you're on your native app for Facebook, and you're looking at your feed. And you think about what each of those items look like. It's got like an avatar of the picture of the person that added the post on the left with a bit of padding around. And then on the right, it's got like a headline and then maybe a blurb and, you know, maybe some other stuff. And there's a whole series of them. So they're all stacked in this big long feed. If you were designing that, say in Sketch, and somebody said, oh, you've got to add like an extra element in there into this one card. Like basically you have like a column of like maybe 20 different items and they're all on cards. And you say, there's this item in the middle there, that fifth card, you forgot to add this one thing. So if you were doing that in Sketch, you'd add that one thing and then you'd take all the other cards. You have to push them down just the right amount. You have to see like what the distance is between each card and you have to recalculate that manually. I mean, Sketch gives you a few tools to kind of do it, but they're not very perfect. And then it would probably take you, I don't know, an hour or two to do that. In Figma, you created that whole thing using this thing called auto layout, where you said, I want each card to be, say, 5 pixels apart. And then if you add something in the middle of there, it'll just expand that or whatever, however it is you said, here's how I want to add new elements. And you could say, I want it to expand height-wise. I want it to expand width-wise. I want it to do whatever. And so now when you go and add that element, it just expands it exactly how you said, and then it just automatically pushes everything down. So the thing that would have taken you like an hour to do in Sketch literally takes no time at all in Figma. Like it's the biggest time saver I've seen in this whole field. It's really killer. So I'm going to go with Figma. I would wear a shirt saying Figma if someone were to give me one.
First of all, this is not an ad. Second of all, that's amazing. Like, so just to have options, people, I will say Sketch because that was my tool. That is my tool right now. And I use Sketch like in a complement with Marble app. Marble app, you do prototyping too, but definitely Figma. Now that Paul is selling us Figma, I don't know, I will switch.
Take a look at it and play with, if you play with, do the online tutorials. There's this guy called Pablo who's just brilliant, and he actually demonstrates these features. Do the online tutorials with Pablo. Look at the auto layout thing, and if you're not sold just based on that, I'd be interested to hear that.
Pablo Stanley, right?
Yeah, probably. That sounds right. I mean, how many Pablos could there be doing Figma demos? But yeah, I think it's him.
True, but I think it's Pablo Stanley. I will check it out and I will put on the episode links. So guide us on how to choose the right prototyping tool. We talk about Figma, we talk about Marvel, we talk about different kind of programs, but how I can choose the right one when I have a project.
So, like I said before, prototyping is going to involve throwaway work. And so part of the decision is to produce the least amount of throwaway work. So, for example, in Axure, everything you do in Axure is going to be throwaway work. There's nothing that you can export from Axure that's going to go into the final product that's going to save any developer any time whatsoever. Basically, it's all throwaway work. HTML, like if you do an HTML prototype, oftentimes that's going to be throwaway work, especially if you've got like a prototyper who built it, who's not part of your actual development team. They're going to do their thing, and probably the development team is going to just start from scratch and do it their way. The only time that that's not that case is if your prototyper is actually one of your developers. But even then, it's probably still the case. Like a developer that's prototyping is going to do a bunch of shortcuts. Whereas a prototyper that's doing final development is going to do it the proper way. So either in all cases, there's throwaway work. The thing that I not to keep banging on the Figma drum, but the thing that I do like about Figma is that there's less throwaway work because basically I haven't moved my designs anywhere. They're already there, and I could go back to designing and make modifications to those designs, and they'll show up in my prototype. So I don't have to like do a bunch of stuff going back and forth between one system or another. And the amount of work that I have to do to create the interactions in my prototype is pretty minimal. Like, yes, all that work's going to be throwaway. It's not going to help any developers, but it didn't take me much time. It's like this button goes over to that screen over there. So that took me like as long as it just took me to say that would take me to do that in Figma. And so so it's the let I would weigh on whichever one is going to require the least amount of throwaway work, and I reckon at the moment that's
Definitely. And this is not an ad. He doesn't have commission.
Figma. I should really, after all that.
So the moment of the truth, prototyping for testing. You talk about usability, and sometimes you need to prototype because you need to sell the concept, but sometimes you need to prototype in order to test it. Talk about process of testing and doing prototype for testing.
So like on the extreme end is that example that I kind of touched on earlier, the medical device company. So in that case, and we had to meet these FDA requirements or criteria. In that case, all I did, I worked for this company, I was a contractor for 6 months. All I literally did was work on this prototype. So basically it was 6 months of
Wow.
prototyping. And it wasn't That was we had three separate tests in those 6 months. We had two formative studies and then the final summative study, and so that was it. So we basically were working towards these studies, and we'd learn something from the first one, and we'd apply it to the second one and the third one, and so forth. When we finally did the test, it was in one of those user study labs with the one-way glass, and they can't hear you and that kind of thing. And so it was like a really rigorous process. So, but that was what was required for that. On the other hand, I've worked for consumer product companies where there is no such rigorous process, and maybe you have a really easy tool for bringing in users like usertesting.com, and I can touch on that a bit later on. But in that case, you can spin up a test in a day. In fact, sometimes we would spin up more than one test in a day because you can create a prototype, or maybe you already have the prototype and it's kind of ready to go. And then you run the prototype, and then you get the results back in like an hour. And then maybe the implications of what needs to change are really obvious from those results. And so you just quickly make those changes. You say, let's run it again. You could run the same test and the same day, and then get those results back the next morning. So sometimes we've done those sort of really rapid prototyping where we're just constantly iterating and like running it past users. So I want to touch on usertesting.com particularly, because basically I did talk about how you recruit for these tests. And so basically you want to find people who are qualified to validate your unvalidated assumptions. So user testing, in case your users aren't aware or your listeners aren't aware, is an online service. And there's some other ones, UserZoom, and there's probably a bunch of others. But user testing is, you've got like regular people who are being paid to do these tests. They're being paid by user testing, but you as an organization have to pay for the user testing service, so they're making their money. And so, but they've got a million, billion users on there that are ready to test all kinds of different things. And so what that means is you can get your results back really fast. You can put up a test and you can ask for 10 people to take that test, and you can get 10 people to take it and get the results back in, like I said, an hour, depending on how long the test is itself. So that's really rapid. However, the problem is the testers, they tend to have a certain bias to them, which is that they get rewarded at the end of you watching somebody go through their test. You get to rate them as a user tester person. So you say, was this tester good? And you can give them a rating. And basically they get called for more tests if they rate higher. So as a result, they will sometimes tell you what you want to hear. So you ask a question or you show them something and they'll go, oh yeah, that's awesome. That's so great. It's like, oh, come on, really? Like, you know, it's just a gray box. And so there's a little bit of that. And also these testers on user testing are not your users. They're the general public. And you can try to select for them as intricately as you can. You can select for income level and where they live and various things. But end of the day, they're probably not using your exact product. So they can only give you insight up to that level. On the other hand, you can actually use your own users. You could say, like, I'm Facebook and I'm going to do a study of 100 Facebook users and I'm going to bring them in. So while that takes longer to recruit, you actually have to find those people through your own methods. There's services built to help you collect them into like a cohort, but it's a fair amount of work. You kind of have to pay them usually, and so that could be expensive. And however, those users, because they're kind of invested in the success of your product because they use it themselves, they're going to be more likely to tell you the truth. So if something's terrible, they're not going to say it's awesome. They're going to say this sucks, because if they don't, then they're going to have to use it. So so those are kind of the two competing approaches for recruiting.
Definitely. You know what? Another kind of tip there is, like, sometimes those users are not in the real space, the real, like, the real opportunity of get the product. So sometimes you will say, like, people came to social media and then try our product. So these people are in an environment that is not the real one. So yeah, definitely we have to take care of what kind of feedback we want to use from there.
Exactly.
We have a section here on the podcast that the name is Horror Stories. And yeah, sometimes people get a little bit like, oh my God, what is going on? But don't worry, I will be nice with you. So the idea is, like, learn from you. Like, what will be your horror story that you learn something about prototyping?
Well, the fact that you call it a horror story is perfect, because it's just like, you ever watch a horror movie and, like, the girl ends up going downstairs into that dark basement room and you're sitting there watching going, what are you doing? Don't go in there. That's where the killer is. What are you doing? And then she's in there and you can see the killer's silhouette. You're like, get out of there. And you're like screaming at the TV. Well, that's been my experience sometimes with user testing, and particularly that medical device one that I've talked about a few times. Is, so we had this thing, it was a product and it was involved medication too. And so basically the app would be where you as a person who takes a number of prescription medications would have to enter your medications into this app and schedule them. And so we had this mental model in our own heads as far as what would be the easiest way to do that. And we designed for that. However, like I said, our users were like kind of in their 60s, even 70s, and they weren't super technical. And so we didn't imagine some of the problems that they would have. And so we'd be sitting there in the control room or whatever, watching this thing behind the one-way glass, and our colleague is in there with the user, and she's like, you know, assisting and guiding them through and telling the instructions and stuff. And we'd see these users get confused on this one thing. They say like, okay, you did that, like, you know, close that screen or something. And we think close that screen is obvious. There's like an X up on the top, right? So like, duh, close the screen. Well, they didn't know that. And so like, they would start tapping on a bunch of other things, and then they'd break the prototype. And now the prototype is not working. And it's not, there's no way they're going to actually be able to get the prototype to work again. They'd have to start it from scratch. And basically the whole test has failed. And we'd be sitting back there going, no, don't do that. And it would be just like the horror story. Now, this was not their fault at all, basically. It's like, they're the users. It was our fault. We just had not imagined, and that's the value of user testing. We had not imagined, and we probably never would have imagined, that you could have made those kind of mistakes until we saw somebody actually do it. And then we're like, oh, we need to think this out a little bit better. And so it was extremely rewarding to see that. But basically, it was just like a horror movie, watching the whole test just crumble to pieces in front of us because we hadn't imagined that one scenario.
So basically, the learning is like, prepare for every weird reason or a scenario that came up.
Well, yeah, but you could overdo that. So basically, it's like, you don't want to waste a bunch of time on an edge case that might just never happen at all. And so like, sometimes it might make sense to take the approach that we did and start with less is more and let the users tell you that no, it has to be a bit more than this. And so like, we could have designed for a bunch of crazy things that they would have done that maybe nobody in their world would ever do. And now we just spend all that time designing for something that nobody's ever going to do. Whereas we saw somebody do this one. So it's like, okay, we know somebody's going to do that. At least that one woman did. So basically, we got to design for that. And so sometimes that's actually a more effective approach.
This is one of the best horror stories, I would say. And I have almost like 100 episodes. So great job, Paul.
Thank you.
Fallando en lo fácil. Basically, it's like, what is the easy mistakes that designers do when prototype? Tell us.
So this is one I see commonly. It's like, we as designers oftentimes don't think about copy, for example, the content that we stick in there. Either we'll use lorem ipsum, or we'll just write our own thing really quickly as we're kind of going. And then as we're prototyping, we might tie together multiple screens that we designed at different times, or maybe some other designer designed some of those screens, so they weren't all designed by the same person. And the copy that wound up on those various screens has no relation to each other. And we don't care because we're not even looking at the copy. We're just looking at the design. We stitch it together and off it goes until this user gets a hold of it. And they're like, say the search engine thing. And they type in something at the top field and they get the results back. And it's some completely other thing because the search results page was designed by some other person and they've created results for some other situation. And so basically making your content make sense logically from one screen to the next is really important, because if the user starts to become confused about your content, which is not even probably what you're even testing for, then basically you've blown your test, because now they're going to be talking about why that says this and it doesn't say that. And they're not going to pay attention to like the great placement of the buttons that you put or the filters or whatever it is that you want to take. And for that matter, I recommend not using lorem ipsum, except at the very, very, very beginning, and not to show to users. And in fact, what I found more effective is to co-design with a copywriter. I've done that on a few projects and it's extremely successful. And so like, especially back to Figma, but basically you could do this in other products as well. But in Figma, you can actually literally have multiple people on the same design, just like in Google Docs, you could all be like working on stuff. So a designer pairs up with a copywriter and they're just coming up with stuff. So this doesn't have to be final copy, but it's like, okay, we got a login screen, and then we got a user preferences screen, and then we got a dashboard, say. And so the copywriter, as the designer is coming up with sort of rough layouts, the copywriter could actually just plop in like some decent, semi-decent copy. It doesn't have to be final copy, but at least it's better copy than most designers would come up with. And so I found that to be really effective. And that makes, that means that your prototype and your designs are all going to be, they're all going to make sort of a logical sense.
So many agrees on this. And we are not selling Figma, but I will say that is so awesome when you see collaboration on one document. Sometimes it can be chaos, like can be like, oh my God, so many changes at the same time. But sometimes like collaboration make products a lot better. So yeah.
Well, I mean, it's like workshopping, you know, like if you're all in a workshop, you can come up with some really cool ideas a lot faster with like, you know, six people in a room, then oftentimes you could, if you just let one person work on it on their own, and you can come up with a wider variety of those. And so, and this is actually going to totally segue into more Figma stuff, but basically it's like to get like two designers on board, especially at the beginning, say you're starting a brand new product and it's total greenfield. You don't have anything to base it on. And you're coming at it from a few different mental models, and you're supposed to come up with some variations to show the stakeholders. Yeah. And so one designer, they might just have one idea. Here's the obvious way that you would do that. And so they would create that. But if you get two designers on there and they're both working on the same screen and it's happening in real time. And the one designer says, oh, I was going to put that up there. It's like, oh, no, I was going to put that over here. It's like, oh, I'm going to create another version. We just created a variation. So now you start to tease out in real time the different ways that people can think about a single solution, and to see it all happening on your screen. And there's no throwaway with this, because basically you're in your final design tool. So whatever you design there could actually turn into your final design. I think that's a really killer feature.
We are almost on the end of the interview. This is the moment that I cry. No, I'm just kidding. This is the final question, and I would love to know, what will be your copy and paste? What will be the good things that you think is necessary designers copy from this interview?
I mean, I'm not going to go off on Figma too much, even though I was kind of planning on answering this question by going doing a final sell for Figma. I think I've probably said enough about Figma. But basically, I would say the big takeaway is, be in touch with your users. Like basically remember that you're designing for those people who have like some problem that they're actually trying to solve. And it's not just the thing that they do to earn a paycheck, or actually maybe it is, but it's a means to an end that's important to them. And you need to embrace that problem and come up with solutions as if it was your own problem. And in fact, in a very real way, it is your own problem. And so the more you can create prototypes, the more you can watch your users struggle through those prototypes or breeze through those prototypes, whichever ends up happening, the more you're going to learn and the better designs you're going to make for them. That's definitely the bottom line.
Definitely. So thank you so much, Paul, for being with us and share your knowledge about prototyping. Designers and listeners, please remember, your designs cannot be just a flat looking good image. You need to like came to life and make it usable. So thank you so much, Paul, for this interview.
My pleasure, Leiqing.
If somebody wants to like reach out to you because have some questions, when we can find you?
You can find me on LinkedIn, Paul Seymour.
There you go, people. Thank you so much, Paul, for this opportunity. And será hasta la próxima, amigos.
Puede buscar más episodios a través de nuestra página web comanzetapodcast.com o seguirnos a través de Instagram, Twitter, Spotify, Apple Podcasts y Google Podcasts como Command Z Podcast, o en Facebook como Command Z Podcast PR. Las opiniones vertidas en este programa son de exclusiva responsabilidad de quienes las emiten y no representan a Command Z Podcast ni a sus auspiciadores.